This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 5th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is Tolerance of Change in PCs. This lecture is 60 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
All right. I've talked to you about smoothing the communication bridge in auditing. I repeat, the purpose of auditing is to increase the ARC of the preclear. But if it does not also increase the ARC of the auditor, it to some degree fails. Now, some of you are discovering that point. Some of you are discovering that after you have delivered a very good session with the processes which we are now using, you feel better. In fact, it could get to a point where auditing was much better for the auditor than the preclear. And the only reason we would be auditing was because we wanted to get in good shape. Now, the truth of the matter is that the running of a body is something you are daily engaged upon on an automatic basis. And I really don't know how a preclear ever exteriorizes at all. Why he responds to auditing at all. I can see how an auditor would respond to auditing, because he's consciously running another body, another mind, another thinking machine, another voice box, isn't he? And therefore, an auditor ought to exteriorize much more swiftly than the preclear. Something to think about, isn't it? Auditor's taking over this automaticity, isn't he? Well, how many hours of auditing somebody else would it require to exteriorize the auditor then? I would say about 889,629 light years. If the auditor's intentions toward the preclear were not clearly understood by himself and tended toward succumb. And I would say that auditing on the reverse vector would be the fastest way in the world to get dead in the head, and would not be something I would lightly adventure upon, believe me. I would no more think, really, of auditing somebody with the full-blown intention of knocking him in, then I would think of going out and dropping this body into a hamburger machine. And although occasionally I might feel like dropping this body in a hamburger machine, I have some vague inkling of the fact that I would not any longer have a body, and I would have to go out and pick up another body. And this would not necessarily be difficult, but none of my friends would know me. And it wouldn't be difficult to make new friends, but I'd think rather poorly of my ability, if I did get another body, then after done that, to get out of that body at ease. Having stacked up a nice overt act. So this is a curious thing, isn't it? There is something which we do not lightly adventure. And that is auditing somebody downscale. Now, how long would it take to exteriorize the auditor by auditing if the auditor was entirely cognizant of what he was doing and his intentions? I would say not very long. If the auditor we're willing to take the responsibility for his various actions. Take the responsibility for his various actions with regard to the preclear. And if he were not sitting back himself waiting for something to happen, let me assure you that that is not something you should likely do either. Do something and then sit back and see if it had a result. Let me assure you of the fact that psychology owes its demise and its unworkability solely to the fact that its modus operandi is sitting back to find out what happened. Listen, if you sit back to find out what happens, you're not predicting the actions involved. If you're not predicting the actions involved, you're not in control. And if you're not in control, then auditing becomes a concatenation of automaticities, and itself can then become a randomity. Plus. Now, are we looking a little more closely at the exact nuances of auditing? We sure are. We're taking it up as a process. That's a very interesting thing to do, to take up the auditing of somebody else as a process for the auditor. That an auditor ever has to be audited at all is interesting, because he must perforce have been auditing a little bit offbeat to have then needed auditing. What is he doing? He is handling and controlling a body other than himself. Now get the difference of statement here. He is not handling and controlling a body other than his own. The whole secret of it lies right there. He is handling and controlling a body other than himself. But a Thetan exterior is handling a body other than himself. Interesting, isn't it? And unless he is very able in handling a body other than himself, and of course this is a rather idiotic statement because there is no body that is a Thetan. There is no body than other than his himself. He is not a body. And his exteriorization of success in his continued exteriorization depends entirely upon his ability to handle a body other than himself. Let's take a new look at auditing. Let's define auditing differently now, just for our experimental purposes here. Just take a look. All right. Let's just sneak up on it a little bit and define auditing, just amongst us guys, as an activity engaged upon by a Thetan to remove to a further and more observable distance a body in order to gainfully practice control. Now, the idiocy of it is you, if you did this, then you would do this and get paid for it. Now, if you did this well, you should get sooner or later up to this very, very interesting point. You should get to a point where you could make your own body do nip-ups, flips, and walk down the street 5 feet above the gravity by postulate. That's a reductio ad absurdum. Nobody expects you to do that. But I only mention it to show you there's some margin for improvement. Now, this business of auditing is most often regarded as sort of a chore. You put in time on somebody else until you get audited. Well, I would say anybody who had that as a very great opinion would probably be found to have another opinion. The communication wasn't very healthy. There was something unhealthy about communication. You follow me? He must have held that opinion at one time or another. There's something unhealthy about communication, and so there could be with a reverse vector. He's evidently had a lot of people around him who had reverse vectors with regard to their communication, who talked to him for his own good, you know. Let's cut you to pieces, you know. And this is all for your own good. Must have been somebody using communication to create a solidity. See this? There just must have been. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had this type of condition resulting that an auditor believes that auditing somebody is restimulative. Now, of course, cutting down the amount of surprise from the preclear advances the auditor's own case. Let's just look at it as a reverse thing now. We see that a number of surprises to the preclear retard his case. Well, a number of surprises from the preclear to the auditor retards the auditor's case. Did you ever audit a preclear and all of a sudden have him shiver and shake, suddenly fall off the bed or blow up out of a chair or do something weird or peculiar? Wham! It's not necessarily hard in your case because you more or less had some expectancy that sooner or later something like this might occur. But it gave you, to a tiny degree, a stuck on the track. You're stuck on the track to some slight, tiny degree every time some preclear did one of these amazing and alarming things. Or when the preclear said, after you've audited them arduously for about 15 or 20 hours, well, nothing is happening. Well, today, we have minimized these things. In fact, we have been working toward this goal of minimizing these unpredictable changes as we know more about not knowing anything. We can raise our prediction level very high. And if we were to do a very smooth bridge between auditing commands, the stop of one and the start of another, if we were to flatten these commands, understand what we were doing with Comlag, understand this going down the track into the past, and coming back up again on successive auditing commands, doing these deeper and deeper and then more and more shallow dives until the individual could take the command with continuous present time. We were to understand these things and execute these things. Let me assure you something, that there would be no shocks to the auditor. Now, it's not that you can't stand shocks. You can stand shocks. You can stand shocks to the degree that you can stand confusion. But if you can't stand any confusion at all, you better not stay in this universe, because its motto is confusion. Its total entrapment character is confusion. Its whole plot is confusion. Your tolerance for confusion should be very high. So I'm not inviting you as an auditor to do a smooth job of auditing, because a bad job can do you in. But I am inviting you to do two things: to examine the intention in auditing, since this is something that could do you in. Your intention is to destroy by commands. Now, whether that is a spoken or an unspoken intention does not matter. If it exists there to some degree, then you will become messier the more you audit. Now, it might be a good thing for you to know these principles for another reason. This is the other one. It might be that everything becomes so ephemeral and so thin and so lacking in solidity that you think you would be much happier if things became more solid. Then at that moment, you should know the exact mechanism by which you make things more solid and make universes much more solid, which is mow them down. That's how you'd go about it. You just start auditing people with a reverse intention. Start communicating in general with a reverse intention. See some good-looking young man and say, how would you like to come over here to a party? And he comes over to the party and you kick the door shut and gun him down. Things would get more solid. In this society, we dramatize this effect by putting people in jail. See, less space, greater solidity in the face of wrongness. See, we just dramatize it. There's no reason to dramatize it at all. As a matter of fact, it justifies the fellow's hostility towards society that they're doing something back to him. Then the society, obligingly, wonderful society, it feeds everybody nice lots of motivators, which they desperately need at that point. You can reason now that law and courts are a great kindness. They attempt at least to feed you as many motivators as you commit crimes. The only trouble with this is their intention is reversed. Their intention is that you should succumb. Of course, you'll get heavier. No doubt about that. Things will become much messier. Now, do you know why space opera is so brutal? Speaking of parascientology, space opera is a very, very brutal operation. There's not much matter. It's all so empty that if everybody started communicating very directly on the intention of survival, you know what would occur? Things would just get emptier. So they go on the basis of, let's develop more horrible weapons. Let's fix up now more destructive orders and regulations. Let's do a lot more implantation. Let's recruit a crew's loyalty by slugging them. Let's do everything in reverse. And maybe if we work hard enough at it, we'll sooner or later have some more planets. Maybe. This is just a method of doing it. It isn't necessary to go about it in that fashion. It's a dramatization, and so we get space opera as a fairly cruel activity, sown with betrayal and upset. To be honest in the activity known as space opera, forthright or above board, is disgraceful. Betrayal, actually, the whole purpose of it, which is all this space should have something in it. And if we can do just enough things wrong and betrayed and upset, and if our communication intention at every turn is succumb, then, we think, things will get a little more solid and we won't have to cruise so far from A to B. So let's say they get a lot of nice solidity. Everybody gets nice and civilized. Nice and solid. And solider. And solider. And solider. There's no game. Well, this is a regrettable state of affairs. Now let's be honest for a while. Let's communicate on a succumb level, everyone says, you see. Let's just be honest and realize that we are going ahead on a succumb level. And let's repent. And let's get out of it by repenting. And realizing that we're all sinning. And that we're all degraded. And things get solider and solider. And everybody says, whoa! Whoa! Now look, we're all good boys. Dwindling spiral. The mechanism which would restore a little more fluidity, liberty, and freedom to the game happens to be simply communication with an intent to survive. But civilizations to date have never done this. We have adopted such things as religion and various repair mechanisms, which seek with more force, more threat, more promises of hell and duress to free people, and of course it just makes things more solid. You can get the idea of a minister from a pulpit saying, and if you don't cease this madness, you will burn forever. This is a good theta communication. Threat, punishment, duress. Now we're going to make everyone good Christians. Erect these crosses, lay those fires neatly. Now let's put some human beings on them. Who's got the torch? Now you stand there and you sing a hymn. And you know, things don't get a least bit lighter. Things don't thin out at all. They just get thicker and thicker. It's almost as though an individual had started a snowball and had decided that it would be a certain size snowball, and then, being on the brink of the hill, it got away from him and rolled on down the hill, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he's saying, hey, wait a minute, I didn't intend to make that snowball that big, and it gets bigger and bigger. Well, now I'm going to take sudden measures here and an emergency treatment, and we're going to stop that snowball, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And he's saying, good heavens, there's nothing you can do about it at all. The snowballs simply get bigger, stable datum. That's the way it goes. And the mechanisms are just those two mechanisms. Very simple mechanisms, aren't they? Very simple mechanisms. Communication with the intent to succumb brings about more mess. Communication with intent to survive brings about less mess. There are only two rules involved in the thing at all. Now, the oddity is that communication with an intent to succumb, you'd think, would bring about more persistence. Because dead things, you know, are so dead. And it does. Messed. But communication with an intent to survive brings about the persistence of life. So it's just which of these two things, messed or life, are you trying to make persist? If you want to make mess persist, you've got to make life succumb. If you're going to make life persist, some mess has got to succumb. And it's just a simple formula. And we've all agreed on this thoroughly enough that it's practically part of native theta. Native state. It's darn near native state. It falls so naturally into view that there's just been universe after universe compounded in this fashion. About the easiest thing a Thetan does. So that you're looking at something which is pretty safe to assume a modus operandi of almost any universe. It's fairly safe to assume that that is the modus operandi of the universe, that its increased solidity will depend upon succumb intentions, and that its decreased solidity and increased life will depend upon survival intentions toward one's fellow man. That's just as simple as that. Now, the thicker things get, the more criminal they get, until they don't move at all. The thicker things get, the more antisocial they get. Now, the oddity is, as we go the other way, and we've experienced a similar manifestation on a higher harmonic. The thinner they get, apparently, the more criminal they get. There's a band up there, above 8 somewhere, which is a band of cruelty, which is an effort to make the whole thing get solid again. But the oddity is that it, too, is a dramatization. And when that band goes by the boards, when one progresses through that band, all that drops out once more. And one regains the ability to do it straight. There's no reason why one couldn't do it straight. You say, you want a plant? Well, muck one up. What's the matter with you? Short on postulates? Mark it up. Change it, change it, change it, change it, change it. Isn't that a nice plant? But as long as one is doing it by the vias and the rules and the agreements, he'll stick between that upper band of cruelty and the lower band of complete motionlessness in mist. And that is the area of trap, from the upper cruelty to the lower inaction. And one just flickers between those two. One has experienced the upper part of this trap. He's made somebody freer and freer and freer, and then the person has done something completely callous. And so he says, free somebody? Oh, no, not me. You can if you want, but not me. We brought complete freedom to this individual, and he was not only bored, but he became very, very cruel, and he did this, and he did that, and so forth, and therefore, hereinafter, as afore stated, no more freedom. There is such a thing as a surfeit of freedom, this individual will say. Well, if his processes were limited, and if he didn't understand what there was on the band in general, if his processes were limited, he would, of course, not be able to shove anybody up through that upper level of cruelty. And as such, would get a stick there and would apparently think he had hit the ceiling. But one might as well suppose that there is an impenetrable shell around Earth at 12,000 feet as to suppose that that upper band of cruelty is impenetrable. It's very rapidly penetrable. As a matter of fact, today, doing good auditing, getting that bridge in there smoothly, not producing these sudden and violent effects on people, restoring his self-determinism, working ahead, one goes through it. You can detect it, though. If we're going through it, let us say, on a lower scale process, such as first postulate Union Station, and that's just lower scale, because it's below other processes we have, not because it's run on low-tone people. It'll go all the way. Things you don't know about that person, things that person doesn't know about you. All right, as we go up with that process, everything is sweet, everything is fine, everybody's lovely, and so on. And pretty clear for a little while. Well, tell you, well, see, what do I don't know about that bird? I don't know the exact temperature necessary to scorch him. We start on up the line in this fashion. And I mean, he breaks through it and comes up into a higher level of cordiality. Sometimes he breaks through it so smoothly and swiftly that you don't even notice it. But if you didn't even notice he was going through it, you're in insufficient two-way communication with the preclear, and he does not trust you enough as an auditor, and therefore you're auditing slowly or roughly in some fashion. If he went through it without you noticing he was going through it, otherwise you would be doing quite a trick. You would be auditing him well without enough two-way communication, which tells you that it would take much longer to audit him than it should. Preclears have confided to me some of the most interesting things without recognition at the moment that they were confiding something to me which was sufficiently antisocial so that the government, if they'd ever heard him thinking that, probably would have hanged them. You know? I mean, anybody could think thoughts like that. This would really have been a problem for somebody, particularly the neurosurgeon. So, as one approaches that upper ceiling, there is not necessarily any danger in leaving a preclear parked there. Because the society is a very civilizing affair. And he has more control over this impulse now than he had control over his lower scale, quote, goodness, unquote. An interesting thing. He is more capable of restraining and controlling his impulses than he was when he was simply being obsessively socially good. Now, an individual who is only socially good by reason of education and not because of desire is a dangerous character to have around. And therefore, we consider man a dangerous character. Let's take something that every man takes for granted. eating. We all take this for granted, eating. What's the darndest thing you ever heard of? Go ahead and eat. Nobody's saying anything about this. But eating itself is the darndest idiocy that anything ever engaged in. You mean somebody's going to have more energy by consuming something dead? Oh, no. Yes, he's going to have more energy, but it's not any kind of energy that's going to do anything for him. It's not for nothing that somebody feels logy after he's eaten a meal. He's just deader than he was before. And so we go off into all manner of dietary fads because we somehow or other dimly feel that there is something wrong with eating. There sure is. There sure is. Now, just because I said this, we should all go on a diet, you know, and not eat at all, because the body is accustomed to it. And the cessation of eating is a sufficiently sudden change to cause the demise of the body. But I'm afraid that is all that is wrong with a sudden cessation of eating. Cessation of eating brings about death by starvation only because it's a sudden and violent communication change. Of course, there's that fellow who weaned his horse of eating by giving him one less straw per day, and who said, "And just as I got the darn fool educated not to eat, he up and died on me." Well, of course, he didn't change the horse's intentions, which is why the horse died. Now, eating is one of the wilder things to engage upon. So much so that there is a league of Thetans. Yeah, there are Thetan leagues around, which are very fascinating. I mean, they're the darnest things. The Anti-Eating League. And they know that eating is bad communication, and so they have devoted and dedicated themselves to a prevention of eating. And they are attacking bodies and trying to kill them to keep bodies from eating. It's actually such a league around. Every once in a while you run into a preacher who has belonged to it. A preacher will be saying, "Well, now let's see. If everyone reduced his food to wheat germ, and ate just 2 spoonfuls of wheat germ per day and 2 cups of water and 1 prune, he would be much healthier." See, they don't dare quite go the all-out statement of stop eating. They don't quite dare go that far, so they just cut it down in a diet. Now, your medico, proper name for an MD, medico, has... Do medicos ever write theses? They have to write a thesis? Huh? They do. I didn't know they could write. Anyway. That's why they're doctors. They wrote a thesis. Now remember that. We're shooting this to pieces a little bit because not here, but in the United States, the word doctor by legislation is being preempted to the medical men. And that is not, it's the darndest thing. It's like trying to change the name of something. Doctor means somebody who has handed in an acceptable thesis. That's what a doctor is, traditionally, over hundreds of years. And it's not something that is just regulated to that. It's also not somebody definitely who has entire monopoly over the entire field of healing, any more than we should ever have the monopoly over the field of healing. Let me interject that. I am speaking from very, very safe ground. We are not trying to displace the medical. We should never have a monopoly over the field of healing. Never. We should never pass any legislation saying that only a Scientologist shall be permitted to heal anybody. Society, you know, might get up to a point where things are too thin. They need a few witch doctors to pound those tom-toms and deafen their patients in order to get them thicker. people might be having a hard time trying to contact the body at all. You need somebody to come along who is a raw red revolutionary and say the proper way to handle this is to beat everybody to a pulp. Oh, and that cures them of everything. You might need that guy, you know? And so we have tremendous legislation passed by this time, saying, it says, by the rules and regulations of any and all, and passed and okayed by all high courts, supreme courts, chancery courts, and auto courts, that no person not qualified by the High Council of Scientology shall be permitted to exchange conversation designed to be therapeutic with any human being. Just remember to tell your kids, the auditors you train when you're 80, God damn your soul if you ever pass a law monopolizing healing. It looks so good. It's just the thing to do, everybody says. It's the quickest way in the world to shut off and drop the curtain. If the curtain ever drops on medicine, it's because medicine passed legislation to obtain a monopoly and did not itself stand on its own 2 feet and ability to continue itself. Started depending on the law of the land to continue itself, and therefore no longer had to be inventive, no longer had to produce, no longer had to be charming to the population. Didn't have to do these things, did it because most of those fellows are good men. See, did it just as a sort of an accidental, but really didn't have to put it across because they were protected by a law. You know, I had a law once, a very, very protective law. It said right there, in time of war, it said, no one must retreat from the enemy. And if he does, he will be charged with the high crime of pusillanimous conduct in the face of the enemy. It's a law. As a matter of fact, I didn't even have a chance one day when 6 Corvettes pulled out, leaving me all by myself. Didn't have a single messenger boy with a good enough pair of Jesus shoes to run over to him and show him where it said that. They went. I remember another thing. Another thing, the Japanese were very good at building small armor-piercing projectiles and firing them from planes. They were pretty good at this. And we had a great big sign on a forward bulkhead, and it says, proof against such and such foot poundage and muzzle velocity. It was a sign stamped on this piece of steel, and the thing was just riddled. So one of the boys got a paintbrush and he painted the sign in red on the front of the bulkhead just so the Japs couldn't miss it next time. So you see, a law is very unprotective in the extreme. Scientologist can't stand on his own 2 feet, and good ARC with the society, it tells you at once he wouldn't be doing very much for the society and he shouldn't perish. That's all the end of that. Reasonable then, isn't it? Nobody ever enforced ARC with the society. All right. We look over this thing called eating, and we find more people dramatizing it. The first thing that a medical thinks of is go on a diet. You go on a diet. You go on a diet. Next thing he thinks of is sacrifice. Out with your appendix, out with your tonsils, out with your adenoids. He knows there's too much of something. and he's trying to work in the direction of making less of it. Now, when he knows this law, if he hasn't legislated himself entirely out of existence by giving himself a complete monopoly over everybody's mind, too, or something like that, he will then eventually pick up such a law. He will know that if he wants less mass, he must communicate toward a survival direct goal. And he actually could communicate toward a survival goal to his people. And he does this to some degree now, his hopefulness with regard to cures and that sort of thing. And he would get less mass. There's no reason to do it suddenly. Now, you know, the only thing wrong with cutting out somebody's appendix or something is because it's a sudden loss. And the suddenness of the change sticks the person in the operation. And the anesthesia sticks him in the I don't know of the operation, so we've got a nice stick, haven't we? And that's all done because it's too sudden for the tolerance of the preclear. And suddenness and confusion are much the same thing to the preclear, or the patient, and I don't know and confusion are much the same thing to the patient. So anytime we would lock these two things together, remove his appendix under an operation, he would wake up not knowing quite when he lost what. It might make a considerable change in him there, see? He might have a bad shock as a result thereof. And that's what operational shock is. You see, I don't know, coupled to the loss of mass. And there he goes. You understand that? Well, then, for the love of Mike, don't take too much away from your preclear too suddenly, and leave him in a big mystery as to how it happened. Do it smoothly, on an upgrade, with ARC, and you'll get the only solvent that really takes things away so that people don't mind it. Now, here's a great oddity. We can take an individual and have him throw away engrams, throw away engrams, throw away engrams. We can coax him into throwing away engrams, and we've gotten all through, he's unhappy. Miserable, he says, look what you've done to me. You've taken all my beautiful engrams. Do you ever have a preclear done? That's why when you say hello and okay to pictures, you have him get them back. And say hello and okay to him and get them back again. Because they keep going away, get them back, go away, get them back. All of a sudden he says, I can get it back anytime I want to. Dickens with it. That's fine. I have a new skill. I have a new ability, and therefore I can afford to throw away something. And he's gotten used to the idea. But all of a sudden we say, if we could, throw away all those engrams. He throws away all those engrams. Good. It's not that loss is wrong. It's that if loss is sudden, if loss is sudden, it produces too much change too fast and leaves a great deal of wonder in his mind as to and what are the consequences and so forth. So that loss must be on a gradient scale. Now, what do we mean by sudden? Remember, I told you about squeezing the trigger of a rifle. If you did it in a tenth of a second, you were still squeezing the trigger, not jerking it. So time, as time measured on a clock, has very little to do with it. But the tolerance of change has a great deal to do with it. So the other factor is the state of mind of the preclear. And this is what you're leading him toward, an infinite tolerance for change. And therefore, with a preclear who is well advanced, you could change this and change that and change something else with great suddenness. And he would consider this the smoothest series of changes he'd experienced in a long time, you see. And with another preclear who has a low tolerance for change, we have this condition. We change the position of 1 foot during the auditing session, 4 hours long, and we stick him on the track. Now, do you see this? The difference between a high-tone case and a low-tone case is high tolerance for change and low tolerance for change, which is what makes time the common denominator of cases. Time is change. Change a position of two or more particles in space. Two, please. Always two, never one. Because something cannot change in relationship to itself. So we have to have two or more particles. Well, the change of position of two or more particles in space is the mechanical definition of time. That is the mechanical definition of time. But remember, I said mechanical definition of time. The other definition of time and the senior definition of time is the consideration of change. So when the individual has a low tolerance for change, his consideration must perforce be that one or two particles moving a short distance slowly is a high rate of change. And a high tolerance for change would be, well, 15 million particles swirling in an irregular pattern is getting just a little thick, particularly when my favorite n-gram is one of the particles and I'm trying to find it. But that'd be high tolerance for change. He'd go on looking for it. Maybe just a little impatient with the fact that there's all these particles, too. You know, he'd say, ah, there it is. The other fellow would see two little things creeping along, and he'd say, eek! So time is basically a consideration, but it's a consideration of what? Consideration of change. Now, the word confusion is not much used by us, and we don't process at the idea of confusion, because the idea of confusion is so different person to person that we have a wild variable in the word itself. We say confusion to somebody, and this to him would mean the room is terribly confused because the picture is 2 millimeters out of plumb. See, so there's a confused room. A confused room to somebody else is that somebody has just moved in and unloaded all of his stuff, has placed it no place, and has not yet disposed of the trunks. And the fellow would say, well, this room looks sort of disorderly, you know, a little bit. The other fellow would say, this room looks awfully disorderly. Look at that picture. It's 2 millimeters out of plumb. Terribly disorderly. Now, this would be all right, but let's take these two people again. 5 people have just moved in, each one with a number of trunks, and all the trunks have been unpacked and dumped in the center of the floor and over the furniture, and only the owners of those objects could be expected to extricate them one from another and put them in their proper places, but there isn't enough space to do this. So the individual who before could tolerate the one set of trunks unpacked walks into the room and says, "Meek!" It's confused. And the other fellow blows the threshold, goes through, and goes into his threshold, and no longer has a resistance or a feeling of capability or order with regard to the situation, because the picture has been changed in its position and he doesn't know really where it was in the first place. And he goes, God, this room is a confused, whirling madhouse. That's his feeling. Now, when you look at your preclear, you're looking at differences between himself and others with regard to rate of change or number of particles. Number of particles, expected order. All of these things are part of it. And it all comes down to what disorder or rate of disorder can he tolerate? Supposing we had somebody coming in and dumping a new trunk full of clothes in the room every 10 minutes. That's regular as clocks, ain't it? Every 10 minutes he'd come in. Well, a fellow could get used to that after a while. He'd take the 10 minutes to kick him over in the corner, and so well, he could get used to that. But supposing somebody varied the rate of arrival on him. One trunk, and now we wait a half an hour to get the next trunk, see? And then we wait 5 minutes, and then we wait 15 minutes, and then we wait 2 minutes, and then we wait a half an hour. And he'd say, I don't know when the next one's going to come. So we get another factor in here, prediction, the predictability of arrival of the particle. Now, there's a tolerance for that. Now, don't assume that all these things are constants. Because if you assume that each one of these is a constant for the whole race, you are merely considering that MEST is very important. So you're considering that MEST is the real thing, the test of it all. There is no standard tolerance for change amongst peoples. You can take through a race that you would consider very excitable, such as the Japanese. They're very excitable people. And their tolerance for change is pretty thin as a race. And yet, we go through the Japanese and we check them up one after the other, and we find their tolerance for change is wildly different one person to the next. So we try this generality of all these people, and we select them out, and we find each one has a different idea of what change constitutes what amount of confusion. Got it? And all this goes back to, of course, I don't know, doesn't it? How many particles flying in how many directions is necessary to represent to the individual an I don't know? You see, now we got, have you got rate of change and confusion pegged? It's quite simple, really. Now we've got to get a preclear capable of tolerating anything conceivable in his environment as a tolerable rate of change, or a tolerable rate of I don't know. And if he can tolerate this in his environment to an extreme degree, then he will never be upset in his environment, don't you see? And he can always remain in control of the environment. Now, true, if we took this fellow that we've processed and he's all right in London, which Lord knows is a fast enough rate of change on its torrents of traffic and so forth. Take a country boy and bring him into London. He goes, zzz, swish. You see him at night and he's a nervous wreck. This, by the way, doesn't go back to conditioning either. Somebody else has just come in from the country, another part. He's looked over London. And I thought this place was a maelstrom of activity. Look at that, all those buses in good order, taxis in good order, everything going predictably. Gosh, London's a nice, orderly place. Just the difference of opinion of two people. Same number of particles going in the same pattern. Now, we take this fellow who could stand London, or that we've processed up to a point where he considers London, and we put him in the middle of a battlefield, and we fix him up so he doesn't quite know which side he's on. And then we have everybody shooting. And then we put him in a condition so he doesn't know quite who he's supposed to shoot at, and tell him he must shoot. We have thousands of particles traveling unpredictably and invisibly in all directions. And the guy gets nervous. You know, he says, horrible. We take another fellow and put him under the same conditions. He says, well, here I am. How do I bring order to this situation? Let me call to your attention, he's a dangerous man to have around. He'll end the war. Generals don't like their wars being ended. Something you mustn't do. That's why generals hate politicians. Politicians, every once in a while, get things squared around and will end wars. They keep saying, fight, you know, on the Civil War. Lincoln kept saying to a general by the name of McClellan, he kept saying, fight, fight. The only reason I mention it is because one of the best studied wars in Great Britain. It is. It is. You go down to your military schools down here and all your maps and laid out and everything else. It's terrific. And they know more about the Civil War than I do. And I fought on both sides of it. Anyway. Sorry, they say, told McClellan, go out in there and fight, go out in there and fight. And McClellan kept gathering men and holding back and gathering men and moving someplace else and gathering men and moving elsewhere and so forth. And he had a nice war going, and he kept getting interfered with. And finally, why, Lincoln got a hold of this fellow named Grant and threw him in there, and Grant ended the war, which his fellow generals never forgave him for. He was a very unpopular general with other generals, Grant was. Very. Say vicious things about him. He drank. Somebody told Lincoln he drank one time, and Lincoln said, well, get the brand of whiskey so I can send a keg of it to the rest of the generals. So here, you see, is a matter of continuous and continuing change, variation, alteration. Now, we get somebody accustomed to a certain level of confusion, and he believes this is his threshold, and he believes that's fine. He is, quote, conditioned. In other words, he has changed his own mind. Nobody ever conditioned anybody. It's a misnomer. He's changed his mind until he believes that this is tolerable. He's living in the middle of hurricanes. Hurricane every 24 hours. New hurricane. He lives there for a while, he says. Hurricane? Of course, he's liable to get upset if he suddenly gets a lightning storm. You know, that'd be a change. Well, we could get somebody at this level, and we could have him in that environment, and he'd think it was fine. But we change his environment, and he goes to pieces. It gets too quiet, or it gets too confused. You want your preclear to be able to change his mind to a point where he can consider anything too quiet or anything too confused. You don't have any kind of a game at all unless you have some confusion. There must be some unpredictability to that soccer ball, that football as it goes down the field. Must be some, or there's no game. There must be some unpredictability to the pattern of formation of the opposing team. Otherwise, there's no game. It's only when the amount of predictability goes above the individual's ability to withstand it or consider it, really, that an individual gets unhappy, or when it gets too little so that he can predict it perfectly and he has no game, that he gets unhappy. See? So you want to free an individual until he himself can alter his considerations of change. And the way you do that is to give him darn few shocks as you go along. Just keep that nice upwards climb of ARC, and the first thing you know, he'll stand more and more. He'll take more and more. You can change much more rapidly, much faster, and it's on the same given process. He's changing much faster. Everything's going along. His tolerance is coming up. And then he comes out of obsessive change entirely and simply tolerates as he considers he should at the moment. Now, knowing that, you should be able to do a very interesting job of auditing. Very interesting job of auditing. Just never give the preclear more change or variation or less communication than is necessary to make him conclude that everything is going smoothly. You follow me? He concludes it's all going smoothly. That's all he concludes. And as he concludes it's going smoothly, so his ARC, his ability to handle the environment, will increase. Now, there is no point on the track where you hit a constant for every human being. See? You never run him through or up to a constant. A amount of change. We have now attained A amount of change. Therefore, our preclear is yap. You have to just do this by feel. How much change can this fellow now tolerate? Well, don't give him quite that much. and increase his ability to tolerate change all the way. And the processes which we're doing do this very easily. Thank you.
Thank you.